Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for the listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Yasmin Albestaki from the Emirates Diplomatic Academy. Today, I'm here to talk to Professor Eve Trout Powell, the author of Tell This in My Memory, Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire. It is a study of slavery, liberation, and remembrance between the 19th and 21st century. Dr. Eve Trout Powell teaches the history of the modern Middle East and history of slavery in the Nile Valley and the Ottoman Empire. As a cultural historian, she emphasizes the exploration of literature and film in her courses. Dr. Trout Powell received her BA, MA, and PhD from Harvard University. She taught for 10 years at the University of Georgia before coming to Penn State University. She has received fellowships from the American Research Center in Egypt and the Social Science Research Council, and has been a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton and at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. In 2003, she was named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow. Dr. Eve, would you like to start off by saying a few words about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study?
Okay, sure. First of all, thank you so much, Yasmin Albestaki, for inviting me to be a part of this podcast. I really appreciate it. My book is not so new, so it's very nice that you're paying attention to it, and I'm quite honored. I do want to let you and your listeners know that I am not a professor at Penn State University. I'm a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, which is in Philadelphia, and people make that mistake all the time. And I grew up in New York City and had no experience of the Middle East, really, until after I graduated from Harvard in the early 1980s, and I went to Cairo, sight unseen, for an internship, a year-long internship at the American University in Cairo. And it's from my experience that first year in Egypt when I decided that whatever I did with my life, it was going to have to get me back to Egypt on a regular basis. So I was generally interested in Middle Eastern history and current events, and I was generally interested sort of in the fact that I knew nothing about this wonderful place and that it wasn't a requirement in our history courses. So, but my interest in race and constructions of race in the Nile Valley, in Egypt and Sudan, really came from observing the experiences of Sudanese friends of mine in the early, well, through the 1980s until now.
Right. Did you have any influential mentors coming into this?
Actually, it took a while for, I had mentors among my Sudanese friends who were really helpful in thinking about this. And I had really great support from the folks at the American Research Center in Egypt and from professors at AUC. And I had a lot of help. In the United States, when I eventually did go into graduate school, I would say that my idea of exploring race was less welcomed, and that people thought that this was not something that applied to the Middle East. And that's not to say that there were not Egyptians who felt that way as well. I have not met any Sudanese scholars or friends who ever discouraged me in the same way that I was discouraged at Harvard. But I will say I do have to name two mentors at Harvard, Zach Lockman, who is now at NYU, and Roger Owen, who passed away about a year and a half ago, became very, very helpful in my struggle and in my studies. And then when I got to Georgia, it was a different approach. I was in a history department. I was not in a Middle East studies department. And that's when I got a great deal of support from my peers and my colleagues.
Mm, that's great. So how does the idea for the book develop? What was the research process like?
Well, the idea for the book came from experiences I had with Dinka friends in Cairo, who the middle of the 1990s, their status in Egypt had become very, very difficult. And they were constantly facing experiences on the streets of Cairo being called abid or slave or, you know, dark-skinned slave. But it also had to do with these churches all around Cairo that had pictures of a saint on their doors. And this picture, it was a picture at the time, 1992, when I was first introduced to her, she was not yet a saint. This was Josephine Bachita, who was a Sudanese slave in the 19th century, who eventually was sold from Khartoum to an Italian master, and she became a nun, and she died in 1947, and she was canonized in 2000. And her portrait or her poster on the doorways of certain churches meant that these were sanctuaries for refugees. And I became very interested in this community of people, most of them domestic workers, who joined in the name of Bachita. And so originally this book was going to be just about Bachita and just about her experience as a slave and what she suffered and who she illuminated. But when I was at Radcliffe, the Institute for Advanced Study there, it became clear to me, with the help of some of my colleagues, that Bachita herself was an important subject. But it was very easy to devolve into hagiography. And of course, she's a saint and well earned her sainthood. But that to really get at the experience of slavery, I had to put the formerly enslaved, like Josephine Bachita, into dialogue with slave owners, because it was often slave owners who were writing in Arabic or in Turkish or in English. Most of the formerly enslaved in the Nile Valley and the Ottoman Empire didn't have access, weren't fluent in these languages, and certainly, or were fluent but not writing fluent. So many of their stories are stories that they told to their owners, and their owners in the late 19th century and in the early 20th century, very famous nationalists, all of them, revealed a great deal. And so the book is about a dialogue between owners and the owned, and what emerges out of those dialogues. Do we learn about how slaves and slave trade fit into constructions of race at a very important time in the Ottoman Empire and in the Nile Valley.
Did you find the writing process to be particularly difficult by bringing these two narratives together?
It got a lot better when I brought them into dialogue together. It was, you know, the Bahita herself, and she's one right. chapter of she had a wonderful story that has been filmed, that has been published, but it's not in her words. She told it to a sister nun. And so trying to figure out how these lives impacted others, it really helped open up a great deal when I also looked at famous writers who owned slaves like Hoda Sha'arawi in Egypt, or Babikar Bedri in Sudan, or Halide Adib Adivar in the late Ottoman and then early Turkish Republic. You know, it just opened up a great deal. And through this, I also found in some archives in Rome that there were former slaves who, through the Catholic Church, did gain fluency in these languages and were able to write their stories. And then it's all about how their stories were framed and how their stories were edited. So I was floundering quite a bit before I had the realization that if I opened it up to include the voices of others, not just the enslaved, even though they were the focus of the book, that I would be able to tell a fuller story.
Okay. Did you find it difficult trying to really capture the authentic voices of the enslaved? Because I think while reading your book, there were sections where you mentioned that it was kind of difficult to really put forward their experience with in relation to the people who enslaved them and what sort of them injecting their narratives into the enslaved narrative.
Absolutely. It was very hard. And I'm not sure that I succeeded. I think I was able to tell a story of lived experiences, but I can in no way presume to present authentic voices, unless these were voices who were not translated, who were able to write themselves. And there's Salim C. Wilson, and also the Catholic priest, Father Daniel, they could do that. But even then, because of the racial tenor of the times, just like in other environments like the United States, people didn't believe that Black people could really talk or really write, and often just disavowed the authenticity. So this question of whether or not one can capture the authentic voice haunts my book, and is part of the tragedy of finding slaves in archives, finding slaves in private archives, you know, how people remember them, right. whether those memories are always true. And we all know that memory can be tricky. This remains a challenge.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So how does the book connect or depart from your previous work?
Oh, this book, my first book, A Different Shade of Colonialism, is right. all about how the British, how during a interesting period of history between 1881 and 1885, Egypt and Egyptians find themselves losing their what I call colony, and I believe it was a colony in Sudan, and then being just at the same time colonized by the British in 1882, and that this strange and important triangle of events created in Egyptian nationalism an element of colonized colonizers and or colonized, yeah. And I wanted to continue to explore that on a more individual basis. So you do see that some of the people that I wrote about in the my first book, I wasn't finished with them yet. So there was, because I realized in the second book how important they were to telling these stories and how important their memoirs are. Although there were some people, I had no idea in the first book what a fascinating figure and writer Halideh Adib Adivar was. She's not in the first book. And Hoda Sha'arawi is in the first book, but not the way she is in the second book. I focus much more on her. And Babakar Bedri is sort of, his memoirs are such a masterpiece of historical thinking and historical writing. And he's so, I think he's just, you know, there's an honesty there to me that is so compelling. So I would say it came out of that that first book.
Did you feel like the first book helped kind of prepare you for the second book in the sense of how you wanted to write it?
No,
not at all.
Not at first. Not at first. At first, when I was really, I mean, for 2 years, I was convinced that I was just going to write about Bakhita, and it just became, it wasn't flowing. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't working. And so then I had to go back to my first book and say, how did I manage this then? And there's a lot of dialogue between people in my first book, and that's what helped me. So I should have been paying more attention to my first book, but it took me a while.
Yeah. But it eventually came together.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's turn to the book. The book contains about 6 chapters in addition to the prologue and the epilogue. So maybe you could say a couple of words about that and the organizational style, how it came about for you?
Sure. Or I can talk to you about the process.
You could.
I tried to keep the book in a chronological order, and I tried to write the chapters in a chronological order. But what really moved me, and this I think is part of my prologue, is what happened to Sudanese refugees in Mustafa Mahmoud Square in Cairo in 2005, the end of the year, when they were protesting and the police came after months. And at first, the neighbors of this area in Mohandasin, and it's a huge business area in this neighborhood of Cairo, were very, very supportive of the refugees. And the refugees also received a great deal of support from the mosque. There's a huge mosque right there. But, you know, homeless camps tend to provoke impatience, and, you know, municipalities and cities and governments are never sure how to handle homelessness and how to handle these kinds of protests. And it devolved into a forced deportation, and the police used hoses and hosed quite violently children and women and men. There were all kinds of pictures in all kinds of papers about this, and it saddened me to my heart. And that's what propelled what I hope is a voice in this book that is one of patience. I hope that my voice reads as genuinely and deeply interested in the humanity of all the people involved, but a serious and deep anger at how racism shapes lives, and how hard it is to struggle through that. So that's what I hope That's what I hope the book has done. And then I went pretty chronologically. I started with someone I had also started with in my earlier book, Ali Mubarak Pasha, who's one of the most fascinating figures in Egyptian history. And we really need a biography of him because he situates himself in such interesting ways in his history of Egypt. And his own autobiography is sprinkled through this very long encyclopedic masterpiece that he wrote, El Khitat. And so, and in this topography, as he's tearing down Cairo at the order of the Khedive and getting ready to build up a new Cairo, he's telling histories, and slaves figure throughout the histories. And it was fascinating. And what comes out of this also is how he, in the late 1880s, how he sees the lives and the impact and the influences of the enslaved, and how he values, you know, and he's very black and white about it. There are black slaves and there are white slaves. And so I was fascinated to see this. And that's what, but that chapter took me, oh, that was so hard to write. And then I just tried to.
Why was it so hard to write?
Well, first of all, El Khitat is, there are no paragraphs. So it's
okay.
A lot of dumb stuff, and you really have to train yourself for his rhythm of writing so that you know where you can see it. And it's fascinating, but it was very... And I doubted myself a lot. You know, I was like, he's really saying black and white in this way? Am I really understanding him the right way? Am I really seeing this? You know, but, and I wasn't able to translate it so that people who were not specialists in Middle East studies, it didn't make any sense. So I must have written this chapter about four or five times. And then things got a little bit easier with the second chapter. Because it's so easily spelled out with Babika Bedri. And then Salem C. Wilson, that was Salim C. Wilson. It was misspelled in the first edition of the book. That too was hard because I felt like I had to fight against the suspicion about the truth of his story and how gratifying it was, you know, to find that there are anthropologists who actually rely on him completely. Hoda and Halliday, I enjoyed writing immensely. I enjoyed comparing the works of these two women. Hoda Sha'rawi's own personal relationship to slavery, to me, is still a mystery in terms of her mom. And Halide Adib Adivar wrote her memoirs first in English because she was exiled from Turkey at the time. And she wrote it while she was teaching at Columbia University. And so she was living in Harlem during the Harlem Renaissance and reflecting on, you know, the slaves that she had owned. And if this woman were alive today, I would so love to talk to her about what were you thinking? What did you see? You know, how did Harlem relate to Istanbul? You know, like just that. And then the rest of the book got easier and easier. And the easiest chapter to write was the one about Bakhita. And so what ended up being hard as its own book was the easiest chapter to write. And I feel like I wrote that one in a trance and in a couple of days.
Yeah. What did you hope, how do you hope people will read your book?
Oh, what a wonderful question. I hope that, you know, when I was writing this book, I was now in both the Africana Studies program. Now it's now a department at Penn, and
right.
And history department, but you know, I have always, I think I've always written my books for a Middle East studies group. This was the first time, or a Middle East studies audience. This is the first time I felt like I was expanding on that and trying to reach a broader audience. And I just feel that the study of slavery has become so fascinating within Middle East studies, and people are so much more open to it now than they were when I first began. And I hope it complicates for people the lives of very famous nationalist historical figures that they know and introduces them to figures that they don't know. And that the relationship between those who owned slaves and those who were enslaved can be very, very complicated. And I also hope that readers of this book will think about race, will really think about race, and think about how it's affected their own lives, you know, how it might have structured their own prospects, you know, what it means to sort of live in a world, and we all live in a world whose economies are based on enslavement.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You mentioned at the beginning that you were not met with a lot of support when you were first, starting out to write this book. Do you feel like now that it's been out and do you feel like it's become easier to explore these topics, of slavery in the Middle East?
This book was well received. It was my first book. It was the book that was my dissertation. Yeah. And I got yelled at in so many places. And, you know, I am African American and people sometimes, often actually, would challenge me and say, don't you dare bring your construction of race to us. What happens in America doesn't translate here. And I was deeply offended, first of all, because, you know, I was figuring out my own construction of race, and you can't just look at me and assume that you know what I'm thinking. You know, we're all very complicated in our approach to our own origins and in our approach to our racial identities. But it was also a criticism that I think made me go deeper in then really listening to people and asking them, okay, well, then what would you call this? And explain this to me and show me this. And, you know, and it was funny, in Egypt, some of my older professors, when I was on the Center for Arabic Studies abroad, for instance, when I was working with professors at Cairo University, would say things like, no, it's not the same here. And then they'd call me up later and say, but I do remember my family. There was somebody, she was, you know, our aunt, you know, but she never married. And they would start to think about, you know, in their own personal histories, who these figures were, who these domestic workers were. And that was so generous and kind of people to share that with me. But also, there is a legacy of slavery in Egypt and in the late Ottoman Empire, and in which there were racial divisions, and those divisions are all over the place still. And there's a whole vocabulary about it. And you can still see it. You know, this spring, there was an outbreak, if you will, of blackface performance all over the Middle East and North Africa that was hugely, I don't even think people knew what they were doing by performing a blackface, or maybe they did. Right. I'm not sure in all instances. And I was in Cairo with my oldest son in October, and I watched a lot of comedies on the channel El Nil, and man, every other movie had someone in blackface, and these were not old films, you know. So I do still think, particularly through the study of blackface, that, you know, there's a way to explore racism in a way that's not always American.
Was the criticism at the beginning that you were getting, you know, about bringing in your own race into it, your own experience as an African American into sort of the discussion, did it make you sort of more careful in how you phrased or how you wrote the chapters per se?
In my earlier work, yes. And my graduate students, some of them think I got too soft in my second book. Okay. I think there's an angrier tone in my first book. But I asked a seminar, a grad seminar I taught about a year and a half ago. I was like, so what do you think of this book? And they told me. they liked the book, but they were like, well, you know, you're not a revolutionary anymore. And I was like, oh. So I'm trying to recover that voice a little bit in my next book.
Well, so what did you, in terms of impact, what would you like it to have? What would you have liked it to have?
I think this book has had a very different impact than my first book. I think this book is, I think the power of narrative is really important, and I really try to respect how to structure a story in a way that would invite people, whether they agree with me or not, to really think about it. And my sense is that it has done that. At least I hope it's done that. And again, as I said earlier, I think it's a book with a broader audience than my first book. And I also
what discussion?
Go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to ask. What discussions were you hoping to spark with it?
I was hoping to spark more discussions about slavery in the Middle East. This book has firmly put me into slavery studies, and it's opened up a new world for me. I mean, I've always been interested in it, but there is definitely a fascinating I think I'm part of the older generation of it, but of scholars who work on the Middle East and North Africa and Africa, scholars like Mike Gomez at NYU, Shukil Hamel at Arizona State, different scholars who have Ahmed Hilal in Egypt, who have really started building on what is the history of slavery in the Middle East. This was done in Ottoman studies by Hakan Erdem and also Ehud Toledano. But I think more and more people from within the region are focusing on the history of slavery. And I think that's really important. And I'm very, very, very proud to be a part of that discussion now.
Oh, that's great. So before we move on to our last traditional question, could you please read a paragraph from your book? Is there a section that you feel that you would like to share?
Oh, my. Yeah, I should have thought of that. I'm sorry, that's my cat editing.
No, that's all right.
Let's see. You know what? I think I would just like to go to the beginning. Okay. I'd like to go to the very beginning. The very first pages in the prologue. Abid, a word with a long history. And I'm going to start with page 2, and it's the paragraph. It starts: "An Egyptian colonist for El Masri El Yom echoed the indignation of Gamal Nkrumah, who is an Egyptian journalist, in an opinion piece published several years later, in which he described watching a young Egyptian woman harass a southern Sudanese woman while riding on the Cairo metro. The reporter, Mona El-Tahawi, intervened only to have the Egyptian girl and her mother berate her and tell her it was none of her business. The young Sudanese woman thanked her. El-Tahawi responded in her article, 'I can only imagine other times she'd been abused publicly. We are a racist people in Egypt, and we are in deep denial about it.' Looking back over recent history," she continued, "what else about race? What else but racism on December 30th, 2005, allowed hundreds of riot policemen to storm through a makeshift camp in central Cairo to clear it of 2,500 Sudanese refugees, trampling or beating to death 28 people, among them women and children?" And then the next page begins, "Many Sudanese refugees would welcome the sensitivity of Nkrumah and El-Tahawi, but may have wondered, as I did reading these accounts, why none of these reporters repeated the exact insults hurled at refugees on Cairo's streets. As I learned from interviews with Sudanese refugees, even before the Mohandaseen incident, the most painful epithet was Abid, the Arabic word for slave, a word intended for darker-skinned people of African descent. I think the silence around this word, even between the most caring of observers, reflects a larger silence about the legacy of slavery that connects Egyptian history to Sudanese history. When the Egyptian government spokesman, Mr. Radi, expressed his bafflement about what the Sudanese refugees were fighting for, he also disclosed a lack of awareness about how the southern Sudanese are connected, painfully, to Egyptian society."
You know, thank you for reading that passage. I guess a question I would like to ask, because you have visited Egypt quite often, do you see... Sorry?
I've lived there, too.
You have lived there, yes. Okay. So what was your... with writing this book and kind of, you know, reading these historical accounts and then living in, you know, a modern Egypt, did you feel like you saw the remnants of it while living there, you know, in the daily experiences that maybe perhaps would have not been so clear to people, would have not been so clearly defined, you know, within the fold of the society living there, because it was just viewed as something normal, and you kind of coming in from the outside and looking through with that historical background, how did you feel that kind of translated for you?
Yes, I mean, that is a terrific question. I really appreciate that. You know, there are many wealthy Sudanese in Egypt, many. Mm-hmm. And certainly we know that, for instance, the Mahdi family, fled to Egypt when they couldn't be in Sudan anymore. And I worked with many members of, these were some of the, they were so generous with me. And they have very good connections with elites within Egyptian society, with journalists, within, you know, they are really up there. And at least at the time I was writing my book, this was the case. And you know, they would tell their Egyptian friends, as I would be there with my late husband, and they would say, you know, you all, once we put on a suit and a rich, you don't call us Abid anymore. But the minute we're, you know, carrying a garbage can or something like that, or carrying a bucket. And that was really interesting. But what's even more important is that when I told some of my less wealthy Sudanese friends who were from the south, from Juba, from Yei, from other places, they were like, why would you go work with these slave owners? So I'm saying this to say that it is such a complicated conversation between these now three countries. Because, so for instance, my cousin came and a lot of my family's in Detroit. My cousin came to visit, and we went to one of the members of the Mahdi's family because we become very good friends at that point. And some of these members are dark-skinned, and my cousin is also dark-skinned. And he was like, well, do you call yourself black? And they were like, look, this is some American thing. We don't even get into that. And he was shocked. And, you know, and so there's that American surprise at looking at people, you know, who we consider very dark-skinned, you know, who are like, I'm not dark-skinned, or I'm dark-skinned, but I'm Arab. And so, yes, I think that that's where I had a lot to learn. I had a lot to learn. But I think, and I think that I was looking at it, I had to learn that what my sense of color was very different than what other people's were in the cities of the Nile Valley. Very, very different. But I still think that my sensitivity to the word Abid and seeing how friends of mine would be deeply, deeply insulted by it enabled me to connect it to the N-word. It's the N-word doesn't mean formerly enslaved, but in many ways it is for the descendants of the enslaved who've kind of seized the word and taken it for themselves. And I also think I'm not the first to have noticed this, that there is a long trajectory of African and African-American intellectuals who have been very curious about the Nile Valley and who have also brought their questions about race to Zionism, for example, or to nationalism. I'm thinking about W.E.B. Du Bois and many, many others. And so, yes, I do think being an outsider helped and hurt, but was important.
But was important, yeah. Did you feel that the word, do you feel or do you perceive the word Abd or Abid would be sort of, and maybe this is me looking at it with a Western lens, but do you think it would be taken back the same way the N-word has been sort of utilized by African Americans, you know, as a power statement?
Yeah. You know, I'm so curious about this. I really am. Because I'm being, and I think this is part of what has been a good impact for personally for me of Tell This In My Memory, is that people are reaching out to me from all over the Middle East, from Turkey, communities of Afro-Turks, from communities in Iraq who are now calling themselves Afro-Iraqis, from Saudi students who are raising questions about race. Now these are, you know, not people who are sending out rap videos at this point. And I know, so I don't know, but it would be so interesting to see. And for me, that would mean a greater exploration of videos and music, because that's where I think this takes place.
Which is always fun.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm hoping in the spring, I'm teaching a new course on blackface in the Middle East, or global blackface, because blackface is everywhere. And and sort of looking at when these words are reappropriated, and when they're just outright rejected. But yeah, I did not experience that with my friends, but you know, there is a movie, a video called Slingshot Hip Hop. It's about Gaza, young Palestinians in Gaza, and then some in the West Bank who are rapping very beautifully. And Tupac Shakur is really a big part of their rap training. And you see these young Palestinian kids using the N-word. And I was at a big seminar about it, and I was like, no, that doesn't work. Not for me. And they were I think this would be a wonderful thing to study.
Definitely, yeah. Well, you've taken up a lot of your time. But I guess I'm going to close. I could talk to you all day, to be honest. I guess to close off is, what are you working on now? What are some current projects, future projects, or what do you hope to work on?
I'm working right now on a book about the visual culture of slavery in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at photography and the use of photography to depict slaves throughout the same time period, through the middle of the 19th century to the first quarter of the 20th century. And this comes out of the editor for Telus in My Memory, Kate Wall, at Stanford, saying that a chapter I have where I really wanted to explore photographs, she thought that would be better in another book. So that was the impetus for this next book. Right. But I've gotten deeply into the paintings of Orientalists and sort of the trade in images of slaves. And I'm deep, deep, deep into this right now. And that's what I'm working on at this point, and really enjoying it.
Yeah, well, it sounds really interesting. I can't wait to get my hands on it. Okay, that would be great. So thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explore Telus in My Memory, Stories of Enslavement from Egypt, Sudan, and the Ottoman Empire, which is a study of slavery, liberation, and remembrance between the 19th and 21st century. This is your host, Yasmin Albasteki. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in Indian Ocean World.